Okay, welcome everybody. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Farouk Master is not new to our interviews. He's been very generous with his time over the last years, and he's conducted quite a number of these interviews. They're always amongst the favorite interviews that we ever do, just because he always injects so much enthusiasm, such great clinical tips and wisdom, and they're always very, very useful in terms of being able to go out and study and practice homeopathy more effectively. Let me give Dr. Master a quick introduction. Dr. Master studied homeopathy at the LCEH and also medicine at the Medical University of Rajasthan. Dr. Master has practiced homeopathy full-time since 1980, and he's taught all over the world, India, United Kingdom, USA, Canada, Norway, Poland, Austria, Hungary, Greece, Germany, and many other parts of the world. He's affiliated with the Hahnemann College of Homeopathy in the United Kingdom and Canada, and also the London College of Homeopathy in the UK, also Norks Academy for Natmudistan, probably poor pronunciation, that's in Oslo, and also the Small Poland Homeopathic Physicians Association in Krakow, Magyar Homeopathic University in Budapest, and also many other institutions around the world. He's the professor of homeopathic materia medica at the Homeopathic Medical College in Bombay, and he's authored over 50 books on various homeopathic topics. He's also the editor of the Homeopathic Heritage in India, and he's a member of the Central Council of Homeopathy, Ministry of Health and Welfare for the Government of India. He's written just so much and done so much in terms of his teaching, but really I guess what I'd like to share more than anything else is what a wonderful human being he is. Aside, yes, he's one of the most knowledgeable homeopathic practitioners on the planet today. He's a tremendous educator, somebody who really cares about his students really being able to go out and take his clinical information and apply it in their own practices and studies of homeopathy. But besides all of that, Farouk is just a wonderful human being. And to give you a sense of that, if you went and asked any of my staff, any of my employees, what they think about Dr. Farouk Master, they would, every single one of them, a smile would come across their face, and they would say, "Oh, Dr. Master, we love Dr. Master." And the reason for that is because when Farouk comes to the United States and he's here as an esteemed teacher from across the planet, and he comes to offer one of these seminars, he's out helping the employees, he's carrying boxes, he treats everybody with the greatest respect, and you can see this in his patients, in his students. So we have on the phone today somebody who's not just a gifted homeopath and teacher, but somebody who is just a wonderful human being and somebody I'm proud to be able to call a friend. So with that quick introduction, Farouk, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So Farouk, I know, first of all, I just want to mention to everybody that Farouk is coming to North America and will be offering, and if you're anywhere near where he's going to be teaching, I strongly suggest that you make the time and find the resources to attend one of his seminars. He's, as I said earlier, a very gifted teacher and somebody who has a tremendous mastery of homeopathic medicine, all facets of homeopathy. So he'll be in New York on October 23rd through the 27th. Farouk, I don't know how people would get more information about that. Could you tell us? Do you know how, if they want to get in touch with the people in New York, how they would do that or where they could find more information?
Yeah. The best way to be in touch with me in New York is to be in touch with Dr. Norman Suhu, and I can give you his telephone number.
Okay. Can you do that, Farouk?
917-371-2017.
Okay, fantastic. And then he's also going to be teaching in Chicago October 28th through the 31st. Would they also contact Norman for that as well, or is there another contact information?
Yeah, there's another contact information for that.
Okay.
It is care of Mr. Tommy, T-O-M-Y, and his contact information is 001-2284-89831.
Okay, great. And then finally, I know that Dr. Master will be doing an extended, almost kind of summer school seminar. This is like a more full study, intensive, so really worthwhile to attend. It's going to be about 4 or 5 days. It's going to be in Carlsbad, which is near San Diego in Southern California. And if you want more information about that, you can contact Jane Cairns. Her email is T as in Tom, P as in Paul, Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S, C-A-I-R-N-S, at sbcglobal.net. That's S as in Sam, B as in Boy, C as in Cat, global.net. So T.P. Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S, at sbcglobal.net. And again, October 23rd through the 27th in New York, October 28th through the 31st in Chicago, and November 2nd through the 6th in Carlsbad in sunny Southern California. Okay, so Farouk, again, thank you so much for joining us. I thought I would start, since you are going to be doing this seminar in Carlsbad on the miasms, and since there's so much controversy about, you know, what actually is even a miasm, since there's so many different definitions, I thought we could start by you having answering the question of, since there is so much of a difference between Hahnemann's concept of the miasms and the contemporary definition, why do you feel this is the case, that there's such a difference between these two?
Okay. As far as I know, the history of miasm which Hahnemann proposed, the knowledge about the disease and its pathogenesis were not known in detail during the time of Hahnemann. As you know, that Hahnemann was treating epidemic of cholera without even seeing a case of cholera, without knowing any medical knowledge of cholera, purely because he believed a lot in the law of similar and the law of symptom totality. As the medical science advanced post-Hahnemannian era, the knowledge of medicine kept on increasing and physicians started to look at the concept of miasm in a different way. Let me give an example of Dr. Roberts. Roberts came some 50 years to 60 years later than Hahnemann. Yet when he wrote his book on philosophy, he mentioned SORA as a functional disturbances due to deficiency disorder. See, here Robert is talking totally of a very different concept. He says there is a deficiency in the body and that is why a person suffers from a soric miasm. And then later on, when still the knowledge of the medicine kept on growing more and more, in the 18th and the 19th century, the whole concept of miasm started to take a large shift, where Dr. M.L. Dhawale, an Indian homeopathic physician, projected his theory again of SORA and tubercular due to some deficiency. So here he is now adding a new miasm, tubercular. After post-Dhawale, there was a null. There was nothing new which is coming up. It all stopped after the theory of nutrition. And then suddenly, Dr. Shankaran projects a new theory, bringing new miasm in between the main fundamental miasm. That means between SORA and psychosis, he will bring malaria and typhoid miasm, something like that. But this whole concept, which has taken place of producing new miasm, just because the medical disease has advanced, basically doesn't match with the original thinking of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann. Hahnemann always wanted miasm to understand the individual and to predict the primary cause, or what is known as the fundamental cause of the disease. He very clearly mentions this in his chronic disease. Unfortunately, the present miasmatic scenario is purely based on the observation of the disease, which is very, very wrong, because it has then nothing to do with the sick individual. So this is what I have to say about it.
Farouk, you mentioned some of these new miasms, like the malarial miasm and the ringworm miasm. So, you know, obviously the original ones were SORA, psychosis, and syphilis. What is your feeling? Are these three miasms, in your opinion, sufficient in the treatment of chronic disease and managing chronic disease, or do you think that there's a need for additional miasms?
Okay. Let me tell you one thing. Actually, according to me, this new miasm that have cropped up has brought rather more confusion, and it is not being understood properly. Hahnemann called miasm as a dynamic disease producing an agent responsible for chronic disease. But the contemporary homeopathic physician who follow this new method, their understanding of miasm is that they are the defense mechanism of the individual, and the reaction of the individual depends on the miasm. Now, this is what I really don't understand, because it is totally tangent to what Hahnemann wants us to understand in his chronic disease. Also, these miasms are not dependent on disease diagnosis of the case. This is clearly written in all the new books which mentions this new miasm, that they have not dependent on the disease diagnosis of the case. Yet, when you study this miasm, they are totally dependent on the disease diagnosis of the case, which is complete paradoxical to what they write in the initial chapter. Let me give you an example. Example, Anacardiaceae family, ringworm miasm. The remedy Rus Veneta. This remedy has been described in detail into the book Insights into the Plant, that herpes eruption also suggests ringworm miasm. Also, while describing the remedy Upas under Longinaceae family, the author says that the word search for Upas showed references to ringworm and herpetic miasm. So the miasm could be ringworm. Now, this is something very paradoxical, because you see a reference of a disease within a remedy, you cannot call that remedy is a very strong ringworm miasm, or it is a very strong herpetic miasm. You cannot call like that. That totally destroys the fundamental thinking of Hahnemann, A, and that totally is paradoxical for what they themselves write in the introductory chapter of the same book. So I think so. It really confuses the student. It really confuses the practitioner, because here on one hand, we are identifying miasm to identify the fundamental cause of the disease and to find out what has really gone wrong over the different generations in the same family. And here you are talking something very unusual, that you read a remedy, you find some name of the disease within the remedy, and you call that remedy as that particular miasm, like typhoid or ringworm or herpetic.
Farouk, you know, it seems to me at least that miasms can be compared to religion, because if you look out there, it's like everybody has their own, their own way of looking at it and their own approach, and all these different factions and different definitions. Do you have any idea why is this so? I mean, this isn't in other areas of homeopathy that we see this, but in when it comes to miasms, everybody seems to have their own definition. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. This is very true, because whenever I travel abroad, I see that every teacher, every student think or have a very different concept of the miasm. Now, let me tell you, the main thing is that Hahnemann always warned the physician when he projected the theory of miasm, that you have to put my theory of chronic disease and miasm at the bedside, at the clinical level, in front of the patient who is lying on the bed and who is extremely sick. Apply my theory to those, and then interpret whatever results you get at the bedside and see how does it work. I have put those principles in my practice in last 30 years, and what I have seen is excellent results, where I could treat some very, very advanced pathology applying those miasm on a sick patient at the bedside. The modern physicians, the modern authors, basically have really not bothered to apply those principles at the clinical bedside. Hahnemann always wanted us to see, please prove my principle before you accept my theory. This new modern medicine, this modern miasm, has really not been clinically applied to that extent. Just one or two cases You do it in hundreds of cases, and then you present that cases in a seminar and show it to the students and say, Wawa, this is not right, actually. It has to be used in every single case, day in and day out. And I think so that is the main reason why these modern teachers, you know, cannot compare themselves with the theory that Hahnemann proposed.
Farouk, just to go off a little bit, there are some teachers out there who, you know, they don't even think about miasms when they're prescribing. They just give a remedy, the remedy that best fits the characteristic symptoms of the case, and they say, you know, we don't need to think about miasms. As long as we give the well-indicated remedy, that's enough to cure the patient, even in the case of chronic disease. What is your opinion? Is it all as necessary to give what's called an anti-miasmatic remedy, or
yeah,
is it sufficient to simply prescribe based on the totality of the characteristic symptoms?
I think so. Here also there are two school of thoughts. The one school of thought purely believes that the indicated remedy, if purely based on the totality of symptom, should totally cure the illness. And there is another school of thought who always believes that to give an intercurrent remedy, which is mostly an anti-miasmatic remedy, is necessary to complete a cure. What I see is the mixture of both, that there are no hard and fast rule applied. Every case decides what he wants. But in a very chronic case, especially those cases where there is a lot of suppression by allopathic drugs or by vaccination or by chemicals, such cases will surely need anti-miasmatic remedies to complete the cure. And here, no one single remedy or the constitutional remedy will play the game. So you need such kind of anti-miasmatic remedy to complete a cure.
Farouk, what are the features in a case that you look for when you're trying to understand the miasm of the case?
I think so. The aphorism number 5 is the best aphorism as a reference material for this question, where Hahnemann, I'll just quote Hahnemann if you don't mind, that he says that useful to the physician in assisting him to cure are the particulars of the most probable exciting cause of the acute disease, as also the most significant point in the whole history of the chronic disease, to enable him to discover its fundamental cause, which is generally due to a chronic miasm. In these investigations, the ascertainable physical constitution of the patient, especially when the disease is chronic, his moral, his intellectual character, his occupation, mode of living and habits, his social and domestic relations, his age, sexual function, etc., are to be taken into consideration. So this aphorism number 5 clearly says that in an acute disease, you are looking for an exciting cause, and in a chronic disease, we are looking at the fundamental cause, and this fundamental cause you can only derive by knowing his past history, family history, and his hereditary pattern, that what sort of disease he is, you know, suffering in the whole generation, and then from those diseases, you interpret what miasm he is passing through.
Interesting. Farouk, when you give, you call a miasmatic remedy an intercurrent, is that what you call a miasmatic remedy? It's when you give, you're giving that as an intercurrent remedy?
Yeah. Sometimes what happens is that even after giving an anti-miasmatic remedy, the case may not come to a complete cure. And here you may require the original constitutional remedy then to carry on the progress. The perfect example would be, let's say, in a case of a boy who has a very chronic asthma and his parents were also equally asthmatic, and his constitutional remedy turns out to be lycopodium. We treat lycopodium and then you suddenly see that everything is much better, but yet the tendency is still persisting, that once in a while he still keeps on getting such attacks. And if the symptom indicates a remedy, Medorinum, which now comes as an anti-miasmatic remedy because of the history of a strong psychosis, we interpose Medorinum. Medorinum removes out that rest of the tendency. But yet what happens in the patient is that he may not now develop a full-fledged asthma, but of course he will get some irritation in the nose, some sneezing, which keeps on coming at a regular interval. Now here, again, repeating the original remedy, Lycopodium, will finish off the case, and there would be no symptoms now remaining in the case. So it does happen that you start with a remedy, then you interpose anti-miasmatic remedy, and then again you go back to the main remedy.
Farouk, do you see that there's a strong correlation between the chronic or constitutional remedies and certain nozodes? Like, for example, maybe with sulfur you see psoriasis, and with phosphorus you see tuberculitis. Do you see that, or is it fairly random, the remedies that you see in relationship to each other?
Okay. Let's put it that way. Basically, most of the polycrates, which Hahnemann has described in Materia Medica Pura and in chronic disease, they are all multi-miasmatic remedy. It may happen that some remedies are more in a particular miasm and less in a particular miasm, like Calcarea Kab will be more psoric and less tubercular. But Calcarea Fos will be more tubercular and less of psoric. But they are multi-miasmatic. You will see some syphilitic trait in Calcarea Kab, and you will see some syphilitic trait in Calcarea Fos, but it will be too minor. So all this polycrest remedy has got their graph of psora, psychosis, tubercular, and syphilis. In majority of the cases where you are the purely a constitutional remedy, which is of a deep acting variety, is indicated, one may not need anti-miasmatic remedy like nozodes so frequently in the case. But sometimes when you are using a remedy which is not a very constitutional remedy, but let's say an average, in between remedy. It is neither a constitutional nor a very short-acting remedy. Like I can give an example of Sabadila.
Okay.
Let's say a person needs Sabadila for his chronic complaint of intermittent fever. Now here you will require some anti-miasmatic remedy because Sabadila is not a very, very deep-acting remedy. So it may require some support of an anti-miasmatic remedy. But if you are constitutionally treating a remedy with a patient with a Calcarea Kab or a sulfur or a Lycopodium or a Mercury solubilis, then the chances are less that this anti-miasmatic remedy will come into the show.
Farouk, you mentioned a moment ago about giving the chronic remedy, the constitutional remedy first, and then, it doesn't work as well or it stops working, and then you give the anti-miasmatic remedy, and then you go back afterwards to giving the constitutional or chronic remedy. Is that the way you always see it, or are there cases where you'll actually give the anti-miasmatic remedy before, or do you only use it when you come across a kind of miasmatic block in the case?
See, it all depends. I'll give you an example. I recently treated a child who comes to me with a very resistant variety of pulmonary tuberculosis. And he took lots of anti-tubercular allopathic medicine for his pulmonary tuberculosis. But unfortunately, the doctors say that the drugs are resistant on his body and he no longer can be improved with modern medicine. He comes to me for homeopathy. And what I see him, even the parents had tuberculosis, even the grandparents had tuberculosis. This particular child was a very hot patient, lean, thin, emaciated, poor appetite, evening rise of temperature, strong craving for meat. Now when I see this child, I see a very strong tubercular miasm, because known from the grandparents itself, the disease itself, tuberculosis, and the strong symptoms of tuberculinum. Now, here in such cases, I always start with an anti-miasmatic remedy like tuberculinum koch. I give tuberculinum koch in 30 potency, and the improvement was instantaneous. And now, I think so there are more than 4 months passed with this remedy, and the X-ray has already started showing changes towards the positive side. So here in such cases where the miasms are pretty heavy, the load is very heavy, in such cases, I do start my first prescription or the opening prescription as a anti-miasmatic remedy.
Interesting. Farouk, you know, you mentioned the tubercular miasm. Could you describe it for us a little bit, and maybe even give us, just to make it a little bit more concrete, some case examples?
Okay. Tubercular miasm, as you know, was added to the theory of Hahnemann by Dr. Crompton Burnett from England. And it was also in the olden days, known as pseudosora, because it primarily combines psoric and syphilitic characteristic together. Now, to identify a tubercular miasm at the level of the mind, the most important thing that I look forward is the sharpness of the memory. Intellectually, they are very keen and have a very great memory. They're quite impatient and restless. That's another point to identify them. If it's a pediatric age group patient, then there's a strong history of temper tantrums, and they're quite destructive. And this individual, they crave for constant new ideas, new excitement, new stimulation. But at the end of the day, they are totally dissatisfied. They are quite daydreamers. They change friends, they change doctors, they change job. They usually have a short, superficial, but an intense relationship. They love traveling, they love mountains, they love fresh air, they love open spaces. They find sea too boring. They are easily fatigued. They are good beginners but bad finishers. So they tend to have many unfinished projects in their life. They are quite cheerful, optimistic, and they are quite artistic. So these are some of the mental traits that I have identified when I have to think of a miasm tubercular.
Could you give us maybe an example of like a case or something? Would you have that available that you could
share with us? Now, see, in majority of the pediatric cases that I see in my practice, I think so 75% of the children suffer from tubercular miasm, because the most important physical aspect of the identified tubercular miasm is tendency to recurrent cold. Now, this is such a common tendency that you will see in 80 to 85% of patients in my practice. The second important condition where I identify tubercular miasm is tendency to recurrent infections, whether it be virus, fungal, or bacterial, makes no difference. Then comes tendency to suppuration. This is also a very strongly tubercular miasm. So see, three important tendencies are very frequently seen in my practice. And based on these tendencies, along with the mental traits which I would just describe, I identify my tubercular miasm. To treat this miasm, we have got two very important remedies. One is tuberculinum, and the second which I use is the bacillinum.
Farouk, could you tell us a little bit, you know, a lot of people are confused about the differences between tuberculinum and bacillinum. Could you maybe go through a little bit of what are the actual differences between those two remedies?
Okay.
Both in terms of what they're prepared from and also the symptomology that would differentiate them?
Okay. Now, see, over the period of years, tuberculinum basically has got many varieties also in homeopathy. The one which I use the most is the tuberculinum bovinum. That means it comes from the animal kingdom. It is made from the glands of a cow who suffered from tuberculosis. So that's why we say tuberculinum bovinum. So it was a tuberculosis of the cervical gland, and that particular part of the cow was used. Whereas in bacillinum, it's a very different story. In bacillinum, the bacteria was identified, along with the tissue debris and the necrosis within the tubercular substance, and that was potentized. While in bovinum, it was not microscopically identified, the tubercular bacilli, but we knew that this organ is suffering from tuberculosis, so we just macerated the tubercular gland and made tuberculum bovinum. So actually, if you see, it's not a very big difference, but when you are looking from the eye of the pathology and bacteriology, yeah, in bacillinum, the bacilli has to be present in the tissue sample along with the tissue necrosis. So this is the origin of the remedies. Both have been proved, but they have not been proved a lot in a classical Hahnemannian way, both the remedies. The proving is more from the clinical aspect. So one has to be very, very careful, because there are very few original symptoms of these two remedies. And there are many common symptoms between them. Why we many times confuse these two remedies? Because it has the same fears, fears of cats, fear of dogs. Development of the child is arrested, lean, thin, emaciated child. Anger, temper tantrums, striking, and restlessness. These are the very common features of both this remedy. What differentiates bacillinum from tuberculinum is the indifference part. Bacillinum has got lot of indifference, especially to the surroundings, to the sufferings, to the relations, and indifference to eating. Many bacillinum children will have all the food of the world on the table, but the child will refuse to eat. So this is a very important indication of bacillinum and not. Second is the anxiety about money matters, which is a very strong symptom I have seen in bacillinum. Aversion to school. This is another symptom which I have verified in bacillinum. And bacillinum children are somewhat like chamomilla, answering snappishly to whatever questions you ask. Whereas in tuberculinum, at the level of the mind, the children are quite abusive, but adventurous, and very, very artistic, talented, and creative. That goes more in favor of tuberculinum and not bacillinum. Many autistic child will require tuberculinum. Tuberculinum has got aversion to certain persons, so they are quite friendly with certain group of people, they are quite strongly averse. They will never go. Lot of fears, but especially the fear of animals and in the night. So this is another very important thing I have seen. And the strong desire for blue, green, and white color. Many times I ask my pediatric age patients to identify what color fascinates them, and they pinpoint to blue, green, or white color. They are quite optimistic people. They love to wander. They love to run. So these are some of the basic difference between a tuberculinum and a bacillinum.
Interesting. Farouk, carcinosin is a remedy that we see a lot of. We prescribe carcinosin quite a bit. I mean, I've talked to a lot of colleagues of mine in the United States, Canada, even in Europe, and we seem to see carcinosin a lot. I've prescribed it a lot in my own practice. Do you prescribe carcinosin a lot, and what? How do you use that remedy? Do you also use it as an intercurrent nozode, or how do you apply it in practice?
Okay. I use carcinosin even without thinking as an intercurrent remedy, because for me, like it's like any other remedy. And basically, the symptoms which Forbister gave us in the beginning, the 8 or 9 symptoms, I think so these are the most important symptom which should not be neglected. If you want, I can tell you what symptom I think of.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I tell? Okay.
Please.
The most important thing, symptom that I look forward is basically the fear of cancer or a strong family history of cancer. This is one thing which I usually look for. The second important thing which I look for is the cases where there's a background of fright and prolonged fear or background of prolonged unhappiness. So this is what I see also. Then, what I look over here in carcinogen is the fastidiousness. Sensitive to reprimands and craving or aversion, either of the one, for salt, milk, eggs, fat of a meat and fruit. These are some of the very solid symptoms I look for in case of a carcinogen. Of course, it has a very wide clinical variation, and there are more than 3,000 symptoms you will see in carcinogen, and there are many themes of carcinogen that has been described in the literature. But these are all the made-up additions and not the real original ones which Forbister has described in his carcinogen book. So I feel these are the very, very fundamental symptoms that one should first look for, and then maybe you should look for another symptoms of carcinogen.
Farooq, what about the domination from parents? Is this something you see very typical in the childhood of people who need carcinogen?
Okay. Now here, for sure, I have prescribed carcinogen successfully in cases of domination from the parents or a very strong personality. But basically, that is not the key symptom that I will always look for. Because this symptom of domination in carcinogen is a symptom which has been introduced by, I think, so Tina Smith. Tina Smith was the first person who introduced this particular symptom into the literature, where he showed some cases of domination. But in fact, I have many cases of carcinogen where I have used without taking this particular symptom. In fact, I have seen some carcinogen patient quite strong, as strong as Lycopodium, where carcinogen has acted very beautifully in such cases.
Very interesting. Farooq, there's also many different preparations of carcinogen. Do you use any particular one? I know there's one just from, you know, breast sarcoma, but there's one from many different types of cancers.
I only use carcinogen, which was advised by Dr. Forbister. You know, Forbister used the carcinogen that was made from the cancerous tissue of the breast, you know. So that is the carcinogen that I use. But of course, Tina Smith made different preparation of breast cancers and made it into one remedy. And then Tina Smith also wanted to add cuprum metallicum to the carcinogen, and he called that remedy as carcinogen cum cuprum. But I have not ventured into those areas. I plainly use the simple carcinogen of Forbister in my practice.
And Farooq, in terms of the nosodes in general, do you find that in most of your cases where there's chronic disease, you know, more serious types of health problems, that at some point in the treatment you will use a nosode, or do you find that it's not always necessary?
It is not always necessary. The use of nosode comes basically in my practice for two reasons. The first reason is that when an indicated remedy stops working, where every indication of the remedy are still persistent in the case and the case doesn't move forward. This is one case for sure I will use an anti-miasmatic remedy. The second case also where I will use an anti-miasmatic remedy is that the case is moving forward, but the pace of the case, the pace at which it moves forward is very slow. Like, I am not able to remove the tendency of recurrent warts in a person who is under my care for last 1 year. But at the end of the 1 year, he says, no, my warts have really, really reduced than before, but Dr. Master, not totally. This is the case. I know that it is moving at a very slow pace.
Farouk, are you still there? Farouk? Hello? Can other people hear me?
Yes.
You.
Yep, I can hear you.
We seem to have lost Farouk, unfortunately.
Hey.
Yes, hello, who's there?
My name. I'm actually listening to a talk. But anyway.
Oh, yes, I'm not sure. Maybe the phone lines in India went down.
He's on.
Okay, fantastic. Farouk, are you still there?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry, the line got connected for a second.
I'm glad you're back. Farouk, I want to open it up to other people. Let me just ask a couple of quick more questions. One is, in India, which are the nozos which are you most commonly using in your practice? Are there any nozos that you see particularly coming up?
I think
frequently?
The most common nozo that we use in India is tuberculinum bovinum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and bacillinum.
And then after that, what do you use? What's the second?
Imidazolinum is another important nozode.
Okay, good. All right, I want to open up. Let me just before I do that, and let some other people ask some questions. Could you just tell us in terms of the seminar that you're going to be doing in Carlsbad on November 2nd through the 6th? What you plan to be teaching there at that conference? I know it's about miasms, but.
Okay, I'll be discussing the following topics. The first is the acute and chronic disease. Then I'll be discussing each miasm individually, like psora, psychosis, syphilinum. And I'll be talking on combined miasm or the mixed miasm. Then I'll be talking on drug disease and its interpretation in miasmatic concept. I'll be talking on suppression. I'll be talking on the practical application of miasm in your day-to-day practice. And I'll be talking on constitutional and miasmatic basis of homeopathic prescribing with the use of video cases.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And also, for people who don't know, Farouk always has just fantastic cases of people with very serious problems, and he has them on video, and then he shows you step-by-step, you know, how these people can be actually brought to a state of cure through the good practice of homeopathic medicine. So, okay, let me go ahead and open it up and let some other people ask some questions. So, any questions for Dr. Farouk Master? Anybody have any questions?
Could you give me information about the Chicago seminar as well as the country for that contact number?
Yes, Farouk, somebody's asking you again for the information about the event in Chicago. Could you give out that contact information again?
Yeah, I will.
And what country is that in, so we know when to call?
Chicago, the United States.
No, the phone number, though, wasn't.
Oh, okay. Farouk, where was that phone number?
Yeah, I'll give you the phone number right now. It's 001-2248-489-831.
Is that a U.S. number, Farouk?
Yeah, it's a U.S. number.
The U.S. phone number, yeah. So just forget the 00. That's he's giving those numbers because he's thinking about calling from Europe or from India or something.
I just don't recognize the area code, but okay, thank you.
Hey, hopefully that works. If that doesn't work, send us an email and we'll try to track it down for you. Other questions for Dr. Farouk Master?
Yes.
Which version of Arcanon are you using? The classical version or Steve Decker's version or Kunzuli's version?
Farouk, obviously you know Farouk, there's a number of different translations, English translations of the Organon. There's the Dudgeon Berkey translation, there's the Wesselhoff translation, there's the Stephen Decker, Wendell Brewster, O'Reilly annotated version translation, and then there's the Kunzli Naudé translation. So his question was, which one do you use, or do you use more than one? Or?
Version by Venda.
So he uses the Stephen Decker translation that was annotated by Wendell Brewster O'Reilly. It's a very good translation. It's very got a lot to commend it, certainly in terms of the little notes in the side margins and the little explanations. So, yeah, so there you got your answer. Other questions? There was a woman who was trying to ask a question as well just a moment ago.
Yes, I was trying to ask about autism, if he has any thoughts about that or what he can tell us about his approach or, yeah, his experience with autism.
Okay. I won't say that we have a very, very good success in an advanced case of autism, but the case which are very mildly autistic or which has a reasonable, let's say, about 7 to 8 factors of autism in a child, in such cases, we use only constitutional homeopathic treatment. We don't use any specific remedies, but one of the important nozodes that is very helpful in such cases is tuberculinum bovinum.
And you're saying you get good results with more advanced cases of autism. Is that correct, Farouk?
Yeah, very advanced cases of autism, they do not respond so easily to homeopathy. You will have to take help of some other science or some other drugs also to calm the child down.
You're saying that's the case in the more advanced cases, is that right?
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah. And are there any grouping of remedies besides tuberculinum that you're seeing effective in the treatment of autism? Is there any group that you find are particularly useful?
Basically for the behavior where it is quite restless, destructive, throwing a lot of temper tantrums, hot patient, nail biting, and eating well but emaciates. Many autistic children that I have seen are extremely emaciated. So this tendency towards unusual emaciation is very, very characteristic of tuberculinum.
Right. Okay. Other questions for Dr. Farouk Master?
Yeah. Can I ask for any good book for the miasm?
Okay, there are many, many good books for miasm. First, I think so you should read The Chronic Disease by Hahnemann himself. Second, you should read Chronic Disease by Allen. Dr. Allen wrote a book on chronic disease. Then you will get good information on miasm if you read Kant Philosophy. Philosophy by Robert and Philosophy by Stuart Close. One of the best book on miasm by Indian author is by Dr. Dhawale, Dhawale, Dr. Dhawale from India. He has written a very nice book on miasm. So I think so these are the works I would recommend you to read.
Great.
And then there are different Allens, 5 or 6 Allens.
There's 3 Allens. There's Henry Clay Allen, John Henry Allen, and Timothy Field Allen.
Karen Allen, for example.
Karen Allen, yeah. That's a contemporary Allen. You're right. So there's a 4th Allen. All right. I think it's J.H. Allen who wrote the book on the...
Yeah.
John Henry Allen.
Appreciate it.
Other questions for Dr. Master?
Any suggestion about treating vitiligo?
Vitiligo, Farouk.
Yeah, vitiligo, you know, if it's a very generalized condition, it's impossible to treat with homeopathy. Also, vitiligo around the fingers, around the toes, it's little difficult to treat. But scattered spot here and there in the body, not affecting whole body, but let's say only in few parts of the body, easily you can treat with homeopathy. There are no specific remedies. Again, a constitutional remedy. But the one remedy that has helped me a lot in treating vitiligo, especially the cases that I see in India, is mica, M-I-C-A. Mica, in a very low potency, has really helped me to treat scattered spot of vitiligo.
How do you give that, Farouk? Do you give it what potency?
Yeah, I give about 3 to 4 doses in a week.
Mm-hmm.
I don't repeat it too frequently, and as the spot starts improving, I stop giving the remedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good. Other questions for Dr. Farouk Master?
Yes, what was the name of the nozo that he uses for autism?
He was talking about tuberculinum as being, tuberculinum bovinum as being the most common. Other questions for Dr. Master?
Yeah, I have a question about carcinogen.
Go ahead, one at a time, just the go ahead, one of you.
Okay, I have a question about carcinogen. Would
go
you
ahead.
Give it if all the other factors that you mentioned were present, but there was neither a fear of cancer nor a history of cancer?
Of course I give. Of course.
You would give it. Okay.
Of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hello. I would like to ask Dr. Farouk if he can tell us one dose of Nozod would be enough to clear the tendency, or do we need to repeat it frequently, more frequently?
Okay, that's a very good question. It all depends on the case. Normally, I start Nozod with a very low potency, 30. And if the susceptibility of the patient is very good, then there is no need to repeat the Nozod. After just one or two doses of the Nozod or anti-miasmatic remedy, the case will progress further. But in case where the susceptibility is very poor, then you need to repeat very frequently to get that kind of result. But when you repeat frequently, be very careful that the patient doesn't start proving the remedy. So that's the very important thing you should look for.
Great. Other questions? We still have about 5 minutes left, so you have some opportunities. Remember, Dr. Master is one of the most foremost homeopathy experts in the world today, so it's a real opportunity to have your questions answered.
Oh, okay. I have one more question, if I can ask.
Please, go ahead.
This is regarding Staphylococcinum penicillinum. Can you tell us about that, please?
Oxaliplatin, is that the remedy you mentioned?
Penicillinum.
A penicillinum, okay.
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 Yeah, yeah. It's one of a very useful remedy, penicillinum, in my practice. I use it basically for recurrent sore throat.
Brooke, you still there?
Hello?
Yeah, okay, good. Use it for sore throat?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Another very important indication is white or yellowish, non-irritating, profuse leucorrhea, recurrent warts, recurrent acne, recurrent styes, and patient is always worse in a cold, damp weather. Very chilly patient.
Great.
And children who need this remedy are quite fidgety.
Quite, say that again, Farouk, I didn't hear you.
Children who need penicillinum
yep.
are very restless and fidgety.
It's very fidgety. Okay, great.
Okay.
Farouk, we only have a few minutes left. I'll see if there's another question in a second. But, you know, I've had the good opportunity to go to India and go and visit your clinic and see the, you know, all the incredible homeopathy being practiced there and, you know, just all the different people who study under you and then all the students who come to study under the people who study. I mean, it's an amazing if people wanted to come to India and study at your clinic, are those opportunities still available, and how would somebody go about doing that?
You can go to my website, drfarookmaster.com, and all the information is mentioned over there.
So it's drfarokh, master, master, and then .com?
Yes.
Okay,
correct.
Fantastic. Great. And, okay, we'll open up for one more question.
Could you talk a little about the indications for carcinosum with cuprum, that remedy?
Yeah, but I have no experience on that. Actually, Tina Spitt wanted to use this particular remedy, and he had some good successful results after using this remedy. The main indication that he always talked about was that the person is extremely rigid and cramped up, and he suppresses his emotions a lot.
Okay.
Along with the usual symptom of carcinosin, this is the state that you have to look forward, that he is cramped up, totally hiding his emotion, totally suppressing his emotions all the time, and he is very hard on himself, hard on himself. So this is a very leading indication which late Dr. Tina Smith used to use for the remedy carcinosin cum cuprum.
Thank you.
Okay?
Great. If somebody has one more quick question, they can go ahead and ask it.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Dr. Farr, what do you think about Tina Smith's protocol that he talked about in his book on autism?
Yeah. See, I don't agree much with that because it has very less to do with what Hahnemann asked us to do. Basically, he is using remedies after remedies where a person has been taken some vaccination and then he is using the same remedy as in an isopathic form. So I feel what Tina Smith writes in his book is more of on isopathy and very little to do with homeopathy. And I have not used those ideas so far in my practice.
Yeah, I agree with you. I find that a lot of people, though, are the general public is really going for that very much these days.
Yeah.
It's being promoted.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Farouk, I want to thank you again for a very informative, really great call. Hope people will have an opportunity to go and try to see Dr. Farouk Master if they're anywhere close to where he'll be teaching. It really is a fantastic opportunity. So, again, he'll be teaching in New York on October 23rd through the 27th, in Chicago, October 28th through the 31st, and in Carlsbad, San Diego, November 2nd through the 6th. So can everybody give Dr. Farouk Master a big North America thank you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Thank you, Farouk.
Bye.